This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Today marks the 13th day of budget negotiations at the State House, and lawmakers still don't have a clear solution before them. After an increase to the state's tobacco tax died in the House of Delegates last week, legislative leaders are pushing forward with their budget plans that rely heavily on the state's rainy day fund to balance the budget, a plan Governor Tomlin will likely veto, and the Senate Finance Chair says puts the state on the road to a financial crisis like we've never seen before. As Ashton Mara reports, tensions are high at the Capitol as lawmakers continue to look for resolutions.
To say discussions in a Senate Finance Committee meeting Wednesday were tense could be an understatement. After the Democratic members of the committee walked out of a 9:30 a.m. meeting that was then abruptly canceled, senators returned to the committee room Wednesday afternoon to discuss a bill that would increase the state's consumer sales tax by 1%, bringing in nearly $200 million to help close a $272 million gap in the 2017 budget. After a closed-door discussion, Senate Finance Chair Mike Hall says it was clear to him that the bill wouldn't make it out of his committee, but he called the meeting anyway, putting it to a vote.
But at least I just did not want the moment to pass to have an opportunity as the chairman of this committee to put forth a policy that I believe is necessary and will become extremely necessary when we get to January or February of next year.
As predicted, the sales tax increase died on a 6-10 vote. Hall says the bill was his personal plan to help close the budget gap and reduce reliance on rainy day funds and was not the opinion of his caucus. Republican members on the committee split on the measure, some voting for, some against. What the Republican Senate caucus is ready to support, though, is a second shot at increasing the state's tobacco tax. The Senate's Finance Committee was presented with a bill Wednesday that look to increase the tax on a pack of cigarettes by 65 cents, leaving out all other tobacco products. Hall says the bill came at the request of Senate leaders. Senate President Bill Cole.
Honestly, I'm sticking to the cigarette tax because I think it has the best chance of passing.
A proposed tobacco tax increase failed in the House last week. That bill would have increased the tax on cigarettes by 45 cents per pack and also included tax hikes for smokeless and other tobacco products. In the Senate, the bill only received support from one Democratic member. But Cole says as the June 30th deadline to approve a budget before the end of the fiscal year approaches, he believes Democrats in both chambers will join members of the majority and vote for the newly proposed increase.
I think there's a group of Democrats that are starting to say, listen, we have to be a part of the solution. We have to be a part of bringing in this budget. And so I'm sensing that there's growing support for it in the House.
The House voted 44-55, rejecting the original tobacco tax bill, with only one of the 36 Democrats in the chamber voting in favor. House Minority Whip Mike Caputo says his caucus might consider supporting the new proposal if it does one thing.
That some of the money would have to fully fund PEIA without premium increases for those who are working, and particularly those who are retired on a fixed income who can't afford that.
All along, House Democrats have been pushing for a $1 cigarette tax hike, dedicating the money to the state public employee insurance agency to avoid premium increases currently planned for the upcoming coverage year. If, Caputo says, the new revenue was dedicated to PEIA, his caucus may consider supporting it. Senate Democrats, they seem to be leaning towards supporting it, too. Senate Minority Leader Jeff Kessler successfully amended the bill in committee to include a 4% tax increase on smokeless tobacco products and implement a new 12% sales tax on e-cigarette liquids, bringing the bill's total annual revenues to about $100 million.
I'm inclined to support it, not be against that one.
What Kessler says he'd really like to see, though, is the passage of a 0.5% increase to the consumer sales tax in addition to the tobacco tax increase. That 0.5% could bring in around $100 million in annual revenues, decreasing the dependency for the 2017 budget on rainy day funds to around $70 million. Finance Chair Hall says he'd support a 0.5% increase, but isn't sure the rest of his caucus feels the same. The $272 million gap in 2017 grows to more than $380 million in 2018. And Hall says, unless lawmakers address the lack of revenues now, the next governor and next legislature will have an even bigger deficit before them.
So whoever comes in here next year, unless something dramatically changes in our economy in the next 6 months, They face a huge budget deficit crisis going out the door. It'll consume everything next year. It'll have to.
Hall says his unpopular push for tax increases will be, quote, vindicated when the state faces a fiscal crisis like it did just a few decades ago, when West Virginia could no longer pay its bills and had to take drastic measures to dig itself out of a financial hole. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ashton Mara in the State House.
This is West Virginia Morning at 7:49. Mostly cloudy skies today. There's a chance of rain and thunderstorms. Temperatures in the 70s and 80s. A chance of rain and thunderstorms continues tonight with lows in the 60s. And a chance of rain and thunderstorms on Friday with highs in the 70s and low 80s.
Support for the weather forecast is provided by Erie Insurance, putting service first since 1925. Local agents available at erieinsurance.com.
How does where you live shape your needs from government? NPR's Morning Edition is traveling the country to find out in a series called The View From. Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep did a series of reports from Appalachia for the program. In the latest episode of Inside Appalachia, host Jessica Lilly spoke with Inskeep about his visit.
A lot of times we talk on our show about my Appalachia is different from your Appalachia, from people who are here. And that's okay, you know, because we all have different stories. Some of the recent stories that appeared on the series that you did as part of this recent visit to Appalachia were about coal mining, healthcare, the economy, like you mentioned, a little bit of broadband access, tied into politics, basically. Why was Appalachia a place to tell these stories?
Oh, well, I mean, in some sense, you could pick anywhere on the map and find some of these stories. But there's a special nature of those stories in the Appalachian region. You mentioned broadband, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's interested in having pretty good internet. But it turns out that there are several states that are at least partially Appalachian states that are having this big debate, because there are rural areas that don't have good internet, and people in rural areas are saying to themselves, I think very astutely, with the internet, people can live anywhere. And if we get some entrepreneurs to locate in our town because it's pretty, because it's a nice place to live, we can really boost the local economy, and we can take places that have been losing population and they could gain a little. But you need a good broadband connection, or people just aren't going to put their business there. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, how do you do that? The state of Tennessee has had a big debate over this. The city of Chattanooga decided to make itself known as a place with great, fast internet. And the city itself did that job and installed better internet broadband across the city, took the responsibility for that. But the state government didn't like that, mm-hmm. considered that to be government competition with private businesses, and they've actually banned other cities from doing the same thing, except that private companies haven't necessarily been into every little holler to get the kind of good internet that you might like to have. There's a similar debate in North Carolina. There's a variant on this debate in the state of Kentucky. This is a big deal in rural areas especially, and it's really fascinating.
There's also been a similar debate here in West Virginia as well.
There you go.
So were there any unique challenges for you and the Morning Edition crew that you had to overcome, such as maybe broadband access, in order to bring the show to this part of Appalachia?
You know, the cell reception is maybe not what you would like as you're driving around. We flew into Johnson City, Tennessee. We drove across that far western point of Virginia interviewing people as we went. We went into Whitesburg, Kentucky, County, Kentucky, and then back down to Knoxville, which is where we broadcast from. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there are any particular challenges. It's a region that I really love and that I learned a lot about when I was going to Morehead State University, although many parts of it were new to me. I'd never been to Whitesburg, for example. It's a fascinating, fascinating city with fascinating people. And I think the major challenge is just to understand what you're looking at, and to make sure that you're listening to people's real stories. Now, this is really tricky, and I bet you're familiar with this challenge. Mm-hmm. We're reporting on an area that has, for example, an awful lot of poverty. And you don't want to stereotype people as a certain kind of poor person, but you do, as a journalist, want to report on that issue and what it means to people. And so I think it's especially important to make sure that you're listening to the particulars of someone's story.
Mm-hmm. We do talk a lot about stereotypes and how to tell who's telling Appalachia's story and things like that on this show a lot. So now that you've visited this region recently, do you think there will be any continuing coverage of this region? Do you think that the region and its people need more national coverage?
Oh, goodness. I hope that we do. And it's not a subject that's terribly new to me. The first story that I can recall doing on NPR that related directly to Appalachia was in Thurmond, West Virginia.
Yeah.
In the 1990s, on All Things Considered, I did a 13-minute long story about this town with 11 people. I believe we counted them at the time, and we believed there to be 7 people in Thurmond and about 4 more in the suburbs, so to speak. And I got to talk to most of them in the course of a day or two of reporting. And you probably know the story of Thurmond. I mean, it's this amazing historic site that was a very busy, not precisely a coal camp, but near coal camps. And it was a banking center and a business center built on the side of a mountain in New River Gorge. And and now hardly any people were living there when I went there. And the National Park Service was trying to kind of coax people out so they could just turn it into a pretty little historic site.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lovely story. And I've come back ever since, whenever I get a chance. My wife is from another part of Appalachia. She's from upstate New York. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you travel through Pittsburgh and you realize you're in yet another part of Appalachia, or you're going to Wheeling, West Virginia, and across the river into southern Ohio to interview voters in a swing state, and you're in Appalachia. This landscape is on my mind. In fact, I wrote a book. It's about Andrew Jackson and the Cherokees, and it's set in the Southern Appalachians. This is a continuing theme in my work. It's a continuing theme for public media, and it ought to be. First, because the stories are really interesting. Second, because they're really important. And third, because Appalachia has such a great part of the American story and the American identity, which I think some people don't even realize that when they talk about the American story, they're quite often talking about some little part of Appalachia.
That's NPR's Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep talking with Inside Appalachia host Jessica Lilly. You can hear an extended version of this conversation on our website, wvpublic.org. You can also hear the stories from Steve's visit on the latest Inside Appalachia podcast. It's available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. There you can subscribe and listen to this show and catch up with previous episodes. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.